continue what we were discussing last time, and I want to try to say a little bit about how to build a factorization algebra for an interacting theory, and we'll realize it's going to be very hard, and there's lots of problems, but that these problems can be solved using the techniques that Phil discussed in his talk. So last time, suppose you were considering a free scalar field theory. So our field was a smooth function on a manifold, and we had this Lagrangian. So today, I hope you don't mind that I'll change notation a little bit. So Phil used the triangle symbol to indicate the BV Laplacian. Really shouldn't we call it Laplacian, it's divergence. But here, because of that, I don't want to use the triangle symbol to indicate the ordinary Laplacian. So here, I mean the ordinary Laplacian. And we saw that there were if I took some u inside of my manifold and some compactly supported smooth functions, fi and gi, we defined the quantum observables on u to be the cochain complex spanned by things like products of O, F, and O, G, where this element here is in degree minus M. And the differential on the observables is a sum of two terms, the BV Laplacian plus something I'll call Q, using the same notation that Phil used yesterday, where del BV, this contracts 1F with 1G. So this is the integral over M over U. So the meaning of this term is this is just the standard formula for divergence with respect to the Lebesgue measure. So if you recall, if we were in finite dimensions and we wrote down divergence, we would get an expression which is formally identical. And Q is a derivation where Q O G star is the function associated to applying the Laplacian to G. So remember that this is the Laplacian. So the interpretation of Q is it's the lead derivative of a vector field on the action functional. Okay, so this complex is, this differential is clearly the analog of divergence for e to the s over h bar. So what happens? So in the interacting case, so I'll discuss a kind of famous theory where my action phi is integral phi Laplacian of phi.
So you said at the beginning that the plus is
yes, I know, I just, yeah, sorry. I'll try to remember that, so please bother me if I forget. And I forgot it over here, too. Thank you. So in this case, we need to add a term. Which in Phil's notation is bracketing with I, where I indicates the interacting term, interaction. So in ordinary differential geometry, your calculus, what this term means is, so the extra term is the Lie derivative of a vector field on the function phi goes to integral phi to the fourth. So in finite dimensions, we know how to differentiate a polynomial. So we can just apply those formulae in infinite dimensions too, and we'll see what this is. So this extra term, I bracket with, say, a constant coefficient vector field, because this is constant coefficient, and we're going to get a cubic polynomial. And the answer is the integral over x in my manifold of g of x times phi of x cubed. Okay, so this all seems good, but if you're careful, you'll realize that there's a very serious problem right here. And this problem is one of the ways in which the UV singularities of quantum field theory manifest themselves. So the problem, but it may seem very technical, but it's actually important. The problem is that this function phi goes to the integral of g phi cubed is not in the class of functions we considered. Right. Because it's not, for example, the integral over cubed of f1x1, f2x2, f3x3, phi x1, x2, phi x3. So the functions we said we consider, we take, you know, smooth functions and integrate them against phi, or we can take products of those guys. And if we take product of the functions, we'll get something like this. So there's two ways in this in which this guy is not the kind of thing we want. Firstly, the integrand, the quantity against which I'm integrating phi times phi times phi, is not, in an obvious way, a product. But more fundamentally, here, the thing we're integrating phi against is smooth, whereas here, it's a distribution. So instead, so the integral of g phi cubed can be written as the integral of g of x1, the delta function, x1 equals x2 equals x3, times 5x1, 5x2, 5x3. So the problem, this is a distribution. And this is really the problem. Okay, so, well, how might we try to solve this problem? We could just say, well, let's just enlarge our space of functions. But then something else goes wrong. So we enlarge our functions. To say, to include things like phi goes to the integral of some distribution where d is a distribution on M to the N with compact support. Okay. This is going to lead us in a different direction to some other problem. It turns out that BV Laplacian is not defined on this class of functions. And to actually solve the problem, we're going to work hard. We will have to work hard, although I won't give you all the details. Here we have a problem. So for example, if I take F to be compactly supported distribution on U, and G to be another compactly supported distribution on U. And then I try to apply the BV Laplacian to their product. Well, that's going to give me the integral of f of x times g of x. And this is ill-defined, as we can't multiply distributions. So what we're seeing is that as soon as we introduce interactions, our naive techniques of just writing down the divergence, they just completely fail. A conceptual way to understand it is when the measurements we were making were smooth, that meant the things we were measuring could have been arbitrary distributions. So that the functional measure was supported on distributions. And this is a known fact about the actual functional measure of a free theory. And we're seeing some shadow of that. Now, when we try to deform a free theory to an interacting one, because the functional measure is supported on distributions, the interacting term involves products of stuff that's not defined. Okay. So any questions? This expression here?
Yeah, the math phi.
It's not linear in phi. It's if we have a polynomial in phi, we can ask that it's a distribution in the sense, well, it's a multilinear function, so it's something which takes three phi's in this case. Yes, exactly. So here it's a distribution on n cubed, as opposed to being a smooth function on n cubed. Okay, any other questions? So let me sketch a little bit about how this problem can be solved using what Phil said. So here's the idea, the actual solution. We're going to use the observables, which are distributions. But we will mollify BV Laplacian to del epsilon, where del epsilon of the product of two things is the integral of the heat kernel x1, x2 times f of x1 and g of x2. So this is good. This works because the heat kernel is smooth. And as epsilon goes to 0, this reproduces del BV. So what we're doing is we're perturbing the delta function on the diagonal a little bit into something more regular. You might ask, how does this depend on the choice? So maybe I'll be thinking very quick here because I'm kind of repeating some things Phil said. So it turns out, firstly, that del 0 minus del epsilon is co-chain homotopic to, it's co-chain exact. So really, at the level of Q cohomology, this guy is just as good as this guy. So this is just fine, where this P0 epsilon is the integral from 0 to epsilon of the heat kernel. And this operator contracts two OFs by F1, OF2, goes to the integral f1, x, f2, x2, p0 epsilon, x1, x2. So this multiplication, the level of Q cohomology, actually does nothing. So it's good. And that in particular implies that if I take any two mollifications, the difference between them is cochain exact, is Q exact. Okay, so there's one more important step. So Phil explained, let me write it out. So we find that the differentials Q, 1 over h bar of Q plus BV Laplacian at epsilon are up to homotopy independent of epsilon. So we can ask, what about if we add the interacting term? So then we'll get something like 1 over h bar q plus del epsilon. Well, if we just add the interacting term without doing anything, of course we will find something that does depend on epsilon. Surely the interacting term will have to vary to make this differential independent of epsilon up to homotopy. So what we have to do is we add on an interacting term which depends on epsilon. So this is up to homotopy independent of epsilon as long as this guy is I epsilon satisfies the homotopical orderly flow, is what Phil called it. So, in to sum up, oh, there's also one more constraint. This differential and this I epsilon must satisfy the quantum master equation to ensure that this differential squares to zero. So to sum up, we know how to construct factorization algebras for free theories. So factorization algebras for interacting theories can be constructed once we have these collection of functionals, IL, which satisfy the axioms from Phil's talk. Also, solutions to these axioms so to define an IL as a collection of distributions satisfying some differential equations, so it's a well-posed problem to find some solutions to these differential equations. Solutions to these axioms can be found by obstruction theory. So in fancy language, for example, in the language used by Lurie in his paper on deformation theory, they form a formal moduli problem. So I like to think that if you don't want to get your hands dirty and don't want to get into the guts of how constructions work, this is really all you need to know. There is some formal moduli problem whose tangent space you can write down, which will give you a deformation of a free theory. So we are going to get our hands dirty a little bit today, though, because I want to I wanted to talk about in a little bit the concept of normalizability. So for example, in the case of free scalar fields, solutions to these axioms are in bijection with Lagrangians, which are integral integrals of polynomials of phi and its derivatives. But really, these are series in H bar. Series in H bar whose coefficients are Lagrangians. This is what Phil explained. So any one of these will give you a solution to these axioms. So now we run into a problem.
Sorry, yeah. But you need to know about loop dependence somehow. I mean, physically, we do that using Feynman diagrams and figuring out how operators get normalized.
Right. No, this is like a very scheme-dependent statement. I choose a scheme, then I can build my effective action. But of course, these Lagrangians will flow as I flow space, as I rescale space-time. Is that the concern?
Yeah,
absolutely. So I was getting to that. There's going to be some action of the real multiplicative group on the space, which we'll study. So this bijection is non-canonical. So all this statement is really saying is, like, whatever the space of theories is, it's a manifold of this dimension. Like, it's a real, you know, locally it's parameterized by this many functions. I'm not saying this non-canonical choice will give you coordinates on it, but they're probably not very good coordinates. Okay. So here is a problem that there seems to be too many theories. So it's related to what Cheater said. So for example, the integral of, say, phi to the 10th, or 4, should be bad. Bad interaction. And so why do we include it? So the concept of normalizability is supposed to kind of analyze this issue. Yeah.
Why should it be a bad interaction?
What's that?
Why should this be a bad interaction?
Well, I will get to explaining why it's a bad interaction, but the answer should be, if you've read a QFT textbook, they will tell you it's a bad interaction. So there's an old-fashioned answer, which is that this has infinitely many counterterms, and there's a more modern answer, which is to do with how this behaves under scaling, and I'll discuss the more modern answer. So this concept of normalizability is built from something very simple. So the multiplicative, the positive reals acts on Rn. So if F is a factorization algebra on Rn, then so is its pullback. Therefore, this group acts on the set of factorization algebras on Rn. Now, for us, a factorization algebra is our avatar of a theory. So this action is called the Orgy flow, normalization group flow. So F is a fixed point. If lambda star of f is isomorphic to f. So really, being a fixed point is that this is really data. So for example, the factorization algebra of a free massless scalar field. Is a fixed point. So let me explain why that is. So if phi is some smooth function on Rn, we make lambda in the positive reals act on phi. Phi of x goes to, well, first I'm going to change x. And then I want to insert some power of lambda here to make the quadratic term of my action scale invariant. So I think the power is like lambda to the n over 2 minus 1. But it might be lambda to the 1 minus n over 2. I don't remember. That integral phi Laplacian phi is scale invariant. If I make a lambda act on f, my compactly supported functions, remember these are going to be our measurements. By with an appropriate exponent, I want the exponent to make sure that this plus this is n, so that I can integrate them. On g, by lambda to the n over 2 minus 1, g of lambda x, then if I've got all the signs right, then the differential on these quantum observables, which is spanned by OF1, OFN, OG1 star, OGM star, is scale invariant. No, it's for each lambda there's a new factorization algebra. So unlike sheaves, factorization algebras only pull back under local isomorphisms. So if you want, it's like a factorization algebra valued in sheaves. Okay, so if we got the signs right, you know, the point is d is the dv Laplacian plus 1 over h bar q. And if we, I did it again. If we got all the signs right, then this q involves the ordinary Laplacian, and this dv Laplacian involves some integration. And if you know, I got these factors right, then this is just scale invariant. So this commutes with this action. So therefore, it's a fixed point. Okay. So what about deformations? So the tangents, if M is going to denote some kind of moduli of, say, translation invariant factorization algebras, on Rn, the tangent space to the free theory at M looks like it's some big vector space. It looks like the collection of Lagrangians. Well, because the free theory is fixed, this group acts on this tangent space to the free theory, and it turns out that this action can be computed very naively at the level of the tangent space. Well, more or less. I mean, I'm lighting some special thing about dimension two. I'm skipping a small subtlety. Which comes from some quantum effects. By asking simply how a Lagrangian changes under L phi under 5x to lambda at the n over 2 minus 1, 5 lambda x. So I've not been very careful with the signs here, as I said. So there's a reasonable chance I made a sign error, but everything is very elementary. So there's nothing subtle happening here yet. So for example, in dimension 4, I might take integral of phi to the n over 2 minus 1. Well, so we notice here, this is going to have weight minus 4 and phi has weight 1, if I got my signs right. So this is weight n. So this transforms by lambda to the n minus 4. Okay. So if we do some small calculations, and consider SO4 invariant Lagrangians, so the tangent space looks like this. Here's our origin. There's going to be some repelling directions, some attracting directions, and some fixed directions. Right. So some directions where if I scale that deformation gets larger, some more if I scale, the deformation gets smaller. Well, here my scaling is kind of zooming in. That's what I want my sign to be. And some more if I scale, then to leading order, nothing happens. So the directions which are repelling, as I zoom in, these are called irrelevant. Attracting we're getting it backwards. No, sorry, I'm getting it backwards. These are called relevant. Because I always forget which, if I'm zooming in or zooming out, so I get the sign wrong. And fixed are called marginal. Am I getting the sign wrong? Okay, so what's the convention is that, oh, see, the relevant deformations are ones that blow up in the UV. Yes, okay. Okay, so if I'm going to the UV, it looks like this. Sorry. Here we're flowing to small scales.
Can you say one more word about that? I mean, just looking at the picture, I would have thought repelling were the attracting were the irrelevant directions, because if I go along them, it doesn't change anything. Like if I start at the fixed point and I move.
Mm-hmm. So maybe why don't I okay. Why don't I move this down here and I say I'm flowing to the UV, to be flowing to the IR. Will that solve the problems, solve the confusions? So as I flow from a small scale to a big scale, if I go off in an attracting direction, nothing happens. That's why it's called irrelevant, because I go back to where I started. So that's what you were saying. If I go off in a repelling direction, as I zoom out, that becomes a large deformation, so that's an important thing. And the marginal ones, nothing happens at all, at least to leading order. But the sub-leading order corrections to the marginal deformations are very important. Okay, so what do we find? For the 5-4, so the relevant ones let's see. So the marginal terms are just there's only one integral 5-4. If we assume that we're SO4 invariant. Irrelevant ones are, there's a lot of them. For example, and the relevant ones there's only finitely many. For instance, there's integral phi squared, integral phi cubed. I think that's it. So what's this telling us? That even though the space of theories is this huge infinite dimensional manifold. So even though this space of theories is very big, infinite dimensional, then if we look at things from very far away, so looking at things from far away is like looking at a large-scale phenomenon. It's the analog in quantum field theory of studying the long-time evolution of a PDE. Yeah?
It might also be nice to say that you can also have boxes in there for lossy units on your files.
Yes, well, you can't have one here because it brings your dimension too high. And you can't
have...
You
can have like box phi.
What's that?
Oh, box phi.
Phi box phi?
No, just box phi.
That's a total derivative. So I mean, it, certainly in other dimensions, I think in this case that doesn't happen for the relevant ones.
And you don't include integral phi to keep this to be.
Oh, integral phi is. Well, you can integral phi is actually fine. Good point. Integral of phi Laplacian of phi can be absorbed by a change of coordinates. It's not there. So if we look at things from far away, only finitely many parameters matter. Conversely, so I'm not doing a very clear job of this, I think. So this is the Wilsonian picture on like why do we not care about it? Things like integral phi to the 10, from far away, it doesn't make any difference. So conversely, if at small scales, only the marginal and relevant interactions can have good behavior. Because the other ones, which get small at large scales, get large at small scales, and kind of destroy any chance of flowing to a fixed point. Okay, so I think I didn't explain that super clearly, but are there any questions?
Can you actually integrate the algebra so if you are far from the fixed point?
I can't. I mean, some people do this on computers, but I don't know how. Any other questions? No, I was starting with a fixed point, which is the free theory.
Okay.
And the phi to the fourth interaction is one of the tangent vectors, but it's the tangent vector which the leading order doesn't change.
So in the middle board there, the title of it says
4 phi. Ah, yes. Sorry about that. Four dimensional, the free theory. I don't understand. I mean, I feel like I'm only confident saying anything about perturbation theory. So long flows are outside of my remit, I feel. But my impression is that it's often in the UV, things get very large masses, and it's effectively trivial. So what I want to write down now is, I discuss is the kind of corrections to the flow, like the sub-leading order. Corrections. So consider the theory with this integral phi Laplacian phi plus c integral phi fourth. So we claimed that to leading order in c, this is scale invariant. So we can ask, does this extend beyond leading order? And the answer is no. It turns out that there is an orgy flow trajectory in the space of theories. With coordinate c, where the vector field which generates the flow looks like c squared d by dc plus higher order terms. So the linear order, it's a fixed point, but that the sub-leading order, there's a vector field, which if you think about it, because c squared has the same sign for positive and negative things, it kind of flows out like that and in like that. Only one of these two sides of this trajectory is physically reasonable, is will satisfy reflection positivity or unitarity. And this one. So it's going to be, if we get the sign right, it's something that on large scales flows to a fixed point, and on small scales behaves badly because of this sub-leading order correction. Yes. Well, he was asking if the vector, if it was like a Morse critical point, but now I don't recall what the definition of a Morse critical point is. The Hessian is some zero eigenvalues. Oh, you mean saying it's not a gradient flow?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about a Morse function that has a cubic critical point, maybe you try to do Morse theory for it. And I was wondering if it seems like that.
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know that. I mean, this is what I know. And
is there another thing that can happen is you might have a Morse spot function where, like, there is a marginal direction that takes you, like, the really expansion of the space of.
Yeah. that there are exactly marginal deformations. So they, in practice, that can only ever happen if you have supersymmetry, because, you know, in quantum field theory, there's going to be an orgy flow unless something is stopping it from happening. So for supersymmetric theories, there are exactly marginal deformations, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Whether a tangent vector is exactly marginal depends on whether a music coordinate is compatible with that vector.
I'm not sure I understand. I mean, the flow is an element of the tangent space at that point. And symmetry of the tangent space at that point, and we can study its eigenvalues.
Would you
say, what does the leading order of the vector field tell you? So you said it was important that the leading order of that vector field was squared, but you know something.
Well, there's a question of the sign, right? So one value of C, say C greater than 0, is good. It's like unitary. And C less than 0 is bad. I mean, this is kind of convention dependent. And the sign is such that in the IR, with the good sign, for C greater than 0, flows down to C equals 0. So is IR free and UV bad? Now, the important discovery in the late 60s is that for Yang-Mills theory, we have the opposite phenomenon. So Chris is going to talk about this. So that with a good coupling constant, the good sign of the coupling constant flows to 0 in the UV. So this is asymptotic freedom.
How would you schematically compute that?
Yes, absolutely. So that's what I was going to do. I'm going to try to explain the computation. Well, so being somebody who likes perturbation theory, unitary aspects are not really thing, but it's just something about, like, if I look at an integral like this, a finite dimensional integral, one dimensional integral, one value of C is the integral converted is better than the other value of C. So that's all it is. So there's two methods of computation. If we understand the leading order of corrections to the factorization algebra as we deform, away from our free theory. So this you can do quite explicitly. There's a kind of there's a formula you can write down for the leading order corrections, and you can stare at this formula and see that the result, the first order deformation, cannot be a fixed point. So I'm not going to do that today. The alternative method is to compute with the ILs. So let me try to quickly sketch how to do that. And this is going to reproduce the kind of standard computations in quantum field theory textbooks. So let's introduce some notation. So we'll let R lambda be how scaling acts on my field. So if I have my ILs, these are a function of phi, and I'm going to define a scaling action on them. It's going to be something like this. I'm going to get a sign wrong here as well. Maybe it's a square or something like that. So it's just the induced action of scaling of fields, but I also have to scale this cutoff parameter, because of course that scales. Because this L appeared in the heat kernel, the heat kernel looks like e to the minus x1 minus x2 squared over L, L to the minus n over 2. So if I scale these x's, of course I must scale L. So this is the natural way to scale things. And you can check. That if IL satisfies the axioms, then so does I lambda of L. Or lambda of IL. Okay, so this is something which takes one solution of these axioms that Phil wrote down, a family of effector actions, and produces a new solution. So now there's the computation. If we start with integral field passing a phi plus coupling constant phi to the fourth. And we build. I haven't told you how to build these guys. Then IL as a function of C. Then the scaling just has the effect of changing C to something like C plus H bar C squared to leading order in H bar. Maybe high orders in C as well. Okay. Log lambda.
Sorry, I don't understand. What does it mean, build IL of C? Does that just mean C phi to the fourth? No.
It's a, well, for every, we've explained there's this construction for every Lagrangian, we can build a family of ILs. We haven't explained the details of that construction. So I want to build it as from this Lagrangian. This guy has one parameter, so I view it as a function of C. So to understand this, so this is going to get a bit technical. We're going to have to understand how to build the ILs to do the computation. But I'm not sure for this audience is the best way of doing it, because it's kind of more conceptual ways is also useful. But I'll discuss that next time. So how to build the ILs. So naively, I of L is going to be some kind of sum over connected graphs with some power of h bar. And then I'm going to have a Feynman amplitude. I'll just draw a sample one, where I put some propagators on every edge and some interaction on every vertex, where I is C integral phi to the fourth, and my field on the external lines. Now, I want to remove the epsilon dependence, so I should take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. So this kind of sum over graphs is what Phil called W P epsilon L I. So this is good because it satisfies some of the axioms, but we want this to have nice L to zero behavior, to be kind of local as L goes to zero. This doesn't satisfy that. So to solve that, I mean, this is only really sensible when L is bigger than epsilon. So we want to set epsilon to zero. So the problem is that sometimes this limit doesn't exist. So we need to replace my classical interaction by these are some epsilon dependent terms. Which are called counter terms. So by studying these, we'll see the flow. So we're kind of getting into the woods here a little bit. It gets a little bit technical, and I hope not too many people are lost. It's important to understand that for me, that these counter terms have no physical meaning. They are just an intermediate step in a proof. You can do everything without ever referring to them if you want to. They're sometimes convenient for computation, and they'll be convenient for this computation, but I don't want people to get too hung up on them. There's no measurement you can do which will measure them. Right? You can measure the effect of action, but so I would say no. Exactly. Yes. There's a very unphysical choice. On mathematical choice, too. It's like, to build the counter terms, we need to say, what is the singular part of a function of epsilon? That's a crazy thing. So anything that depends on that is meaningless.
Can't you just keep epsilon like 5% satisfied with that?
I wouldn't be satisfied with that because, firstly, it'd be tricky to solve the quantum master equation. And secondly, I mean, some people are OK with that. Secondly, I wouldn't be able to actually build a factorization algebra because the differential depended on the IL. And I wanted L to be local. I wanted IL to be kind of local when L is small so that it preserves the locality condition that I do measurements on a small open. If I just keep epsilon finite, I'm going to kind of increase my open every time I do differential. I don't know. I mean, you want to say that you're effective. This is the effective Lagrangian. I'm trying to build the effective action. But I want it to be defined for all scales, and at small scales, it should be look local. I don't think that's too much to ask for. I don't know. Yeah, as I said, we're getting a bit into the woods. So let's kind of study this a little bit. So what's the first? So tree diagrams are fine. these are fine. So let's first move to one loop diagrams. So the first one we're going to encounter is this diagram. So this is going to, so every such diagram will give you a polynomial function of my fields of degree the number of external lines. So this diagram gives you, well, because there's one vertex I'm integrating over one copy of R4, the integral over x in R4, phi of x squared times the propagator, the integral t equals epsilon to l of t to the minus 2 e to the minus, normally the propagator has two n's, and I would write the E kernel like that. But in this special case, x1 is equal to x2. So actually, this just goes away. So this looks like the integral of x in R4, phi of x squared, times something like 1 over epsilon minus 1 over L. So, does this have an epsilon to zero limit? No, it has a first order pole at epsilon goes to zero because of this 1 over epsilon term. So, but it's very clear what to do. This is a perfectly fine local counter term, just mass. So I can add on that first counter term. Looks like h bar, because it's that one loop, times 1 over epsilon integral phi squared. And let's go a little further. The next diagram we're going to consider. Yeah. I mean, in this game, there's a bunch of diagrams which you can, sane people can only ever compute things in one loop. Computing things beyond one loop becomes very difficult. I find it very hard. And you kind of learn to recognize which diagrams are important and which diagrams will give you convergent answers. So here, what does this give us? Well, I'm going to integrate over two copies of R4. The integral over x1, x2 in R4 of this vertex, I'll have phi of x1 squared. This vertex, I'll have phi of x2 squared. And I have two propagators, which is p epsilon l, x1, x2. That's squared. So we'd like to study the behavior of this as epsilon goes to 0. So this involves doing an integral, which I've done many times, but doesn't mean I can remember how to do it as quickly as I should. So what do we do? So we're going to take I'm going to move, so the propagator itself is an integral, so I'm going to move those integrals out, t1, t2, it's epsilon to L. Integral x1, x, x2, phi x1 squared, phi of x2 squared, t1 minus 2, t2 minus 2, e to the minus 1 over t1 minus 1 over t2, x1 minus x2 squared. Okay. So now we're going to do the integral over x1 minus x2 first. And I'll just do it quickly. The integral over x1 minus x2 is a Gaussian integral. And we're interested in what happens when the t's are small. because when the t's are small, that's where you might have a pole, a small epsilon. So we know how to integrate Gaussian integrals, and we know how to give them an expansion in powers of this quantity here. Since it's a four-dimensional integral, if I remember correctly, if we integrate over x1 minus x2, we get sigma to L, integral over x. The leading term will just evaluate these guys at x1 equals x2, and then there will be subleading terms which won't contribute. 5x to the fourth, and now I'm going to get an expression here. Well, I already had t1 minus 2, t2 minus 2, and you know, if I just integrate this Gaussian, I'm going to get some factor, some power of this thing here, so that's going to be something like t1 t2 over t1 plus t2 to the power of 4, because it's a four-dimensional integral. Any questions? Get this, you know, integral over x1 minus x2 is a four-dimensional integral, so I get this factor. Not the power of 4, power of 2. My mistake. Power of 2. Happier? Yes. Okay. So now, let's bring this guy out. And you just compute this integral, which anybody can do. So this looks like log epsilon integral phi to the fourth. Now, we can ask why. So I just have one second. Mm-hmm. So we're ultimately interested in what happens when we scale everything. We scale everything. So if you remember, we try to write this as this kind of limit. So if we scale things, we find that or lambda I of L is the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of W P lambda epsilon lambda L I minus or lambda I C T lambda epsilon. So we're scaling everything, including scaling lambda. Okay? So let's look at our two counterterms and see what happens. So our two counterterms are epsilon minus 1. Okay, there was a lambda squared here. Lambda squared there too. We're epsilon minus 1 phi squared. If we scale everything, this is fixed. Because I simultaneously scale epsilon and scale all my fields, this operator is a relevant operator. It has some scaling dimension. The scaling dimension cancels that of this counter, of the power of epsilon. So this does not contribute to the flow. But the next one, log epsilon, integral phi to the fourth, gets sent to log epsilon integral phi to the fourth plus log lambda, maybe 2 log lambda integral phi to the fourth. So the fact that when I scale a log, I pick up logs are multiplicative, so I get this extra term, that's what gives us something that's not fixed. So we conclude So if we scale, then this counterterms part gets sent to the same counterterms part plus something like log lambda integral phi to the fourth. So this doesn't have any epsilon dependence anymore, so we absorb it over there. There's a h-bar 2. So this means I gets sent to I plus, maybe minus. So I know this gets very technical, but it's also fun to do these integrals. Are there any questions before we finish? Oh, there was one more point we didn't. Since the diagram which contributes this counterterm looks like this, it has two vertices, so it comes with a c squared. That's where we find this kind of c squared d by dc. I wasn't keeping track of the C's, but the diagram which contributed this counterterm had two vertices. So each vertex has the 5-4 interaction. So that comes with a C. So diagrams with n vertices should come with a power of C to the n. So that's why I pick up a C squared here. So it looks like I'm playing the spectra field. Okay, so. Yeah, so if there's no more questions, maybe I'll stop there. And like, I know maybe next time, I want to go through this because Chris is going to talk about asymptotic freedom today. But next time, I'd also like to explain how to see this kind of failure to be scale invariant in a more kind of algebraic way. It can be made quite explicit. Okay, so I'll stop there. Yeah, yes, there are terms higher order than C, but they're dependent on what, I mean, when I choose a scheme, I choose a coordinate which I call C, and if I change C, the other terms change, but only the leading term will not be changed if I change my coordinate. So the only really meaningful term is the leading one.
All right, let's thank Kevin again.